We'll come to order. We'll start open a public hearing on 2575. And John, you want to give us an idea what this bill is?
Mr. Chair, this is a bill that has been referred to as an implied consent law. It would provide that individuals signing up for a driver's license, driver's permit, or ID card would be considered to have consented to registration for the Selective Service System.
Thank you. And Gary Lockwood.
Chairman and committee members, my name is Gary Lockwood. I'm the State Director of Selective Service for Oregon. I do expect Representative Krupp to be here, and so if he comes in, I'll yield at any time to him for his presentation. This is the basically the same bill that was introduced in the last session, and did not because of a budget. The budget crunch at the end of the session, we didn't get it to the out of the Senate committee. It was processed through the House committee. Okay, if I may.
Take the mic if you'd mind. And I don't know if that's a
you all laughing at
me. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17. It's always a pleasure to testify in front of Transportation Committee. I have spent a couple of years on this committee and loved every minute of it. And it's my pleasure to be here with the Colonel. To talk about an issue that I think is relevant and is very important. The idea that men would have to register for the draft is obviously nothing new. And the reason that I think it's important that we do this is because it's really very simple, because some young men simply, believe it or not, don't know that they need to do it, or they forget about it, and it just doesn't happen. This assures that it's going to get done, that they fully comply with the law. Because what happens if they don't do this, if it's an oversight and they forget, and that really does happen, is they're going to lose the opportunity to get federal loans or grants, go to college, or something later in life. They'll lose student aid. Some colleges, some state colleges, won't even allow you admission if you're not registered. It makes you ineligible for federal jobs down the road. And male immigrants who seek citizenship will in fact be denied if they're not registered. So it has very serious implications if someone makes an honest mistake and just forgets to do it. And that happens. Now, when I turned 18, I was in that very special three-year time period where from 1977 to 1980, I believe, you were not required to sign up for the draft. And then after that, federal law changed again, and young men turning 18 were required to do so. My 26-year-old stepson was required to do so, and when we made very, very sure that he did that when he turned 18. But that doesn't happen for everyone. And I think this is why it's so important that we do this, because it ultimately has a very negative consequence if you just forget. Now, I think there's issues of fairness and equity in here. Conscientious objectors, of which my father was one, are exempt, can be exempt on those grounds, the religious, moral grounds. So The thought that this would impinge on someone's religious views is simply not accurate and would not be the case. My own dad did what's called alternative service because back then you were required. He chose alternative service in the years of the Korean War to spend a couple of years working for Goodwill up here in the Portland area, driving a truck, which is where my parents got married and began their family at that time. And he chose the conscientious objector status, but he had to register. And had he had not opted for alternative service, he likely would have been drafted. So this is a proper direction, in my opinion, and I would really urge the committee to consider what are the consequences to young men who, for whatever reasons, don't get this done, because it can be pretty severe down the road for them. And I think that this is a reasonable idea that helps correct that issue. It's very simple. It just happens at the time that you register for your driver's license. It's that simple. And with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll back away from the microphone if that's permissible, and answer questions if you would like, or go back to my own committee.
Thank you. I think we'll check the questions before you leave. Okay, that's all right. Any questions, Representative Crump?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Crump, in line 67, I don't know if you have a copy of the bill in front of you, but it references for issuance or renewal. Your comments seemed like largely focused on issuance, kind of a one-time responsibility for ODOT to make sure at the time of issuance. Is there a specific rationale for the or renewal, or was that just something LC put in there?
I'll let the Colonel answer that for you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hunt, the reason for that is that there are some licenses issued as early as age 16. And if the person comes back for a renewal, or if there are other circumstances, but it's primarily so that we can reach all of the people between ages 18 and 26.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any indication, either one of you, what the numbers are of young men who don't sign up for Selective Service in Oregon?
Initially, at age 18, the law specifies a 60-day period, 30 days before 18, 30 days after. However, late registration is permissible up through age 25. Oregon, historically, we run in the low 70% at age 18. And by age 19 to 20, we're getting up to about 80%. By age 25, we're about 90%. And this is where the fairness and the equity issue comes in. Those whose names are in the pool would like to have that pool as large as possible. And so that's the fairness and the equity to those who register. The fairness and equity on the other side is that the agency and the Department of Justice made the determination at the very early on that they would not prosecute for non-registration. And just as there's no classification until there is a mobilization. So it's just basically registration is the only thing that's requested of the individual under the law. But the those who don't register by age 26, it's a lifetime loss of those benefits that were enumerated by Representative Krupp. And one that is extremely difficult is the one if a person is in the process of immigration or is not a citizen and does not register by age 26, it can be a lifetime debarment to citizenship. I get calls, I won't say every day, but I get calls often from immigration attorneys on this subject because of that difficult situation. And I also get calls from educational facilities that say, what can we do? We want to extend student aid, but the individual didn't sign up by age 26. There's nothing we can do. It's cut and dry. When you hit your 26th birthday as a male, that's it. It's stopped. So Now, and it's just a matter that we're looking at an easy fix, because I've been state director for about 6 years, and I go out to the high schools to get the points of contact. So what we found is that the 10% that ultimately do not register and lose benefits are the 10% who are not in school, who don't go to college, because if you sign up for student aid, you just check a block, and that's automatic registration. If you're not registered, they just process it and goes in. Online registration now in the high school has been very effective, and we get a very high percentage of high school students, but that's only if they have a Social Security card. So if it's someone who does not have a Social Security card, they still have to register, but they have to do it with the cards that are available in the post office and do the manual registration. There's approximately, we've got about 43 jurisdictions that have enacted this similar legislation, just almost exactly this, but each state has a little different approach to it. And it has worked wonders in getting the numbers. In fact, most of them are showing those that have been have had the bill enacted for two or three years are showing in the high 90s, some at 99% at age 18. And so it does a great job. We try and go out through the Department of Employment, the agricultural outreach. I go out and talk with various ethnic and industry groups to point out the need for registration and the fact that we do not have a working agreement or any other agreement where names are given to immigration or any law enforcement agency. What we're trying to do is get compliance, and I'm convinced, I think a number of other states have been convinced that this is probably the most cost-effective, easiest way to do that, to arrive at that fairness and equity for both sides of the equation. Hopefully in your packet you have one of these maps that show where it has been enacted today. Are there any questions?
Further questions? Yes.
Well, I apologize for coming in late. One meeting running into the next. Is this a draft?
No, this is not the draft. This is just, there is a federal law that says that all males ages 18 to 25 must register. And this is just the furtherance of that requirement and attempting to avoid the pitfalls of the loss of benefits that occur to those who do not register. And the one thing that was touched on that I didn't by Representative Krupp is that the standing to raise the issue of conscientious objector is only available to persons who are registered. If you're not registered, you have no standing to raise that issue. And so it isn't, we're not taking anything away from somebody by registering them. We're giving them an additional benefit. And in the event of mobilization, the unregistered member then is, the alternatives are not pleasant, because then it's going to be before a federal judge, not before an administrative body.
Further questions? Follow up.
Yeah, I'm just going by on the front page of the testimony. 1, 2, 3, 4. In the fourth paragraph, where it says, in the event of mobilization, persons who reach age 20 at a specified date would be called up. That sounds like a draft to me.
No. That's if you have this, there's a small card in the packet that talks about the difference between the Vietnam era draft and a future draft, and I'm going to add the words, if any. At this point, there are no indications of a draft, but the Selective Service is the insurance policy that in the event of mobilization, that we can have a way of supplying the needed manpower for that mobilization at the earliest possible date. And to do that, that means having the local board members trained, and there's one in every county and every parish in the United States, and one or more. And then the other side that we can't play catch up on is the registration, and catch up in a timely manner. I could be replaced by a CD disc. It's that, that's where we are in technology. But I can't replace the 130 board members in the state and train them with a CD disc. And we can't get the 14 or 15 million names into the Selective Service process for the selection. But the age 20 is where it starts and goes 20 to 25 and then back to 19. So the present concept of a draft, if ever, would be not to draft 18-year-olds, but to start at basically age 20, go up and come back if you need to at age 19. Mm-hmm. That's after you've called roughly 14 or 15 million people.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, if I might add that federal law today states that all males of a certain age have to register for the draft. And what you didn't have an opportunity to hear was part of my testimony before you arrived, is that if you make a mistake and you don't, because you're not going to school or you just forget, when you turn 26 and you have not registered for the draft, you're not eligible for student loans or grants from the federal government, student aid. Some colleges won't even let you into admissions, job training benefits. You can never become a federal employee. Well, not never. Most federal jobs you're not eligible for. And another interesting side note, that if you are an immigrant seeking citizenship and you have not registered for the draft, by the time you turn 26, you are barred forever from being granted citizenship in the United States. So those are what all we're trying to do, is to capture that 10% of young men in Oregon who don't register for the draft by just saying, when you register for your license or renew your license between 16 and 26, 18 and 26, that you are automatically registered for the draft at that point in time.
You mean Selective Service or
Selective Service?
Selective Service. Right.
I just can't handle that word.
Yeah.
Indulge me.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate both of you. Ruth Bendel.
Good afternoon. My name is Ruth Bendel, 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive, Portland 97225. I did hear about this bill, and I thought how timely it is. We're in a post 9/11 era. I've lived in a country where war happened very suddenly, and I know the full meaning of the importance of the government knowing where to reach people in the event of an urgent mobilization. We don't know where our adversaries are or what they have in mind for us. We know we have adversaries, and we also need to know that our young people need to know the importance of compliance with laws. We want to trust them, but this is a way to verify that laws get obeyed. And I think in this era, that's very important. That's all I have to say. I do ask you to approve this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you very much. Andrea Meyer.
Chair Gilman, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I am going to testify one of these days in support of something, but not today. Really, I hope so. ACLU of Oregon opposes House Bill 2575, which would force young men to register with the Selective Service upon receiving their driver's license, driver's permit, or identification card. We believe this law is unconstitutional under both Article 1, Section 3, and Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution. First, this law deems driver's license registration consent for Selective Service registration, and as such is an infringement on the religious freedoms of Oregonians who are conscientious objectors. Federal Selective Service registration does not allow someone at the time of registration to declare himself as a conscientious objector. That only happens when the draft is reinstated and if it is, the young man will have 72 hours to report for induction. With that little amount of time, it will only be then that he will be able to make his case that he's a conscientious objector. Article 1, Section 3 of the Oregon Constitution is one of seven provisions in our state constitution providing stronger religious freedom protections than the federal constitution. And it provides in part, no law shall in any case whatever control the free exercise and enjoyment of religious opinions or interfere with the rights of conscience. And when we're speaking of laws, those would be Oregon laws, not federal. Because individuals are prohibited from registering as conscientious objectors, for many, the very act of registering forces them to engage in an activity that is in violation of their religious beliefs. By requiring conscientious objectors to the Selective Service Program to consent to registration, when obtaining a driver's license, the state is actively interfering with religious freedom of Oregonians when otherwise they have not been. Under this proposal, the state would take on the role of requiring an individual to violate his religious beliefs to obtain a state license, and we believe that runs afoul to the fundamental religious protections given to Oregonians. Second, we believe that House Bill 2575 violates Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution, that is our equal protection provision. In the seminal case of Hewitt versus Safe in 1982, the Oregon Supreme Court held that it is unconstitutional to treat men and women differently in the privileges provided by the state. Here, the privilege is obtaining a driver's license permit or identification card, no more, no less. For the state to impose a different requirement on males of a certain age, but not on females of the same age, imposes a state burden on one gender for reasons entirely unrelated to the benefit being provided, that is, of a driver's license. As such, we believe that this law would run afoul of the Equal Privileges and Immunity section of the Oregon Constitution. We believe House Bill 2575 impermissibly puts the state in the role of enforcing the Selective Service Registration, a federal law, by forcing consent to registration when an individual wants to obtain a state-issued driver's license. And we urge you not to pass this bill. Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Nope. Thank you.
Chair Gilman and members of the committee, excuse me, for the record, my name is Philip Kennedy Wong. I'm the public policy director for EMO, that's Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. We are the state association of churches representing 17 Christian denominations in the state of Oregon with over 1,000 churches statewide. I'm here to also testify, I'm here to also submit testimony on behalf of the Oregon Catholic Conference, which is a partner of ours. With all due respect to the sponsors of this bill and to those who have served in the military, we are opposed to House Bill 2575. And let me just read from you the statement that you have before you from the Oregon Catholic Conference, because this is a view that Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon also shares. We believe that there is a significant difference between moral judgments and an individual makes between applying for issuance or renewal of a driver's license permit or an ID card on one hand and registering with the Selective Service on the other. And to combine these two acts, one enabling participation in society and the other an act agreeing potentially to engage in warfare, raises issues of conscience and moral concern. Catholic moral teaching on war and peace contains two traditions, the just war tradition and the nonviolent tradition. For an individual called in conscience to nonviolence, the act of registering with the Selective Service system as required is an act performed with substantial reflection, moral judgment, and decision-making. Our nation recognizes, respects, and supports the exercise of an individual's conscience and the nonviolent tradition through laws providing for a conscientious objection to participation in warfare. And this is stated in the understanding that, you know, in order to qualify for CO status, you have to register with the Selective Service. But to combine these very distinct public acts, as House Bill 2575 does, one in public application form, an application to the Department of Transportation, constituting consent to be registered with the Selective Service is not good public policy because it erases the legitimate and quite profound distinction between these two very important decisions. And what I'd like to submit is that there's a difference between consent and legal requirement, which I understand that once you turn the age of 18, you are legally required to register with the Selective Service, as I did myself. But for, say, like a 16-year-old trying to get a driver's permit, there's a difference in the moral maturity between that of a 16-year-old and that of an 18-year-old. And that does cause some concern if there's, some possibility to address this, that would go a long way. However, with that said, there are very big distinctions, and we would request that this committee not support this bill. And let me give a personal example. I served 8 years in the United States Marine Corps Reserves, and I was so motivated to enlist, I actually enlisted at the age of 17, below, obviously the age of 18. But I had to get my parents' permission to sign off on the papers before I went to basic training. And this, from my understanding with this bill, would not have any sort of consensual opportunity for a 16-year-old or for anyone, for that matter, to make this decision separate, because driving and registering for the Selective Service are really two distinct things that we would like to keep separate. With that, I'll be more than happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Bill. Questions? Yes.
Yes, and maybe this question is better suited for somebody else, but I am not familiar. What is the current process for registering with Selective Service? Is it going to the post office and filling out a form? Is that?
I'm no expert, but that's exactly what I did. I just went to the post office, picked up an application, and I mailed it in. I believe now that's also done through the Internet, so you can register with the Selective Service online.
Okay, I know that when you're getting your driver's license, they also offer you a voter registration card, too, if you're over 18. But it's not compulsory, obviously. I'm just wondering, would it be more, palatable to you if it was just offered as a, here it is, you can do it now, conveniently, and know that if you don't register by the age of 20, whatever warnings that could be provided on paper given to them.
Chair Gilman and Representative Thatcher, we would have to take a look at that. But in general, I think, what we want to encourage is that when people do make a decision, it's such a profound decision such as registering for the Selective Service, that they should keep that decision-making process separate than getting a driver's permit or getting an ID card. I guess what we would be concerned is that, especially for those who are minors, for them to flippantly just, if that's what I got to do, to get a driver's license or a permit or an ID card, I'll just go check off that box. So what we want is to have people take more time to think about it, to make that decision. And I think by separating out that process, you do allow, at least for the possibility of people to take more time to make this decision.
Further questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Philip, I just want to clarify. I think what we're talking about here is not for minors. I think we're talking about only 18-year-olds and above. I think if a 16-year-old, unless I've misheard the testimony or what the bill is referring to, a 16-year-old or a 17-year-old, for that matter, that goes in to get a permit or a license isn't required to do this. It's when they're 18. So if they have to come back in 4 years, it's the second time they come back. Is that correct? Just to help him.
Carrie, would you please come up to the mic and identify yourself again, please?
Carrie Lockwood, State Director, Selective Service. In the language that appears at line 8 and 9 of the bill, if the person is required by federal law to register, and that's what that 60-day period starting 30 days before the 18th birthday and 30 days after, however late registration is permitted up through age 25. On the Internet, there's also a early submission of registration where the a 17-year-old can register, but they do an early submission of registration. They are not technically registered, and a number and a registration card is not issued until they reach 30 days before age 18. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
Another question, though.
Mr. Lockwood, explain the process, then, that somebody that wants to become a conscientious objector would do that. How do they do it? When do they do it?
Because there is no pending mobilization and has not been since the Selective Service Act of 1980. That came about when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. President Truman asked that we go back to having a selective service. It had been basically in standby for approximately 7 years. Okay. The decision was made not to go to the expense of having people come in and go through the physical, the testing, the background check, and everything else at that point, because it was very costly to do that, and also a burden on individuals. So there's been no classification since the act has come back in. In other words, all there is registration. If there should be a mobilization in the future, there would be, you go through the draft, the lottery process, the drums are all loaded, the two drums to do the lottery process, and then based on the number that Department of Defense says are needed, then there would be a formula for whatever they think the percentage would be from that goes out for the caller. At that time, the individual receives a written notice to appear at a MEP station, that's a military processing station, for the physical and the testing. Then from that, there is a period time, and it's more than 72 hours before they are notified that they're going to be called up with a reporting date. They then, a person who wants to be a conscientious objector for religious, moral, or ethical reasons, then would go to the draft board which would, in essence, it would be the Selective Service Office nearest them, and they would be notified where that is in their call-up letter. And they would then make application at that time for a conscientious objector status. It is that then is referred to one of the local boards that is, because this is a judgment determination, that local board would process that. They would be allowed to appear and provide testimony, provide information as to in support of whichever one of the three or a combination thereof of those positions. And there's two conscientious objector positions. One is that would willing to serve but not bear arms. The other is not willing to serve at all. And they would then make their presentation to the board. The board then, and it's five, requiring a three for a quorum, and that board then would make a decision on whether or not that individual would be a conscientious objector. If the board ruled against the individual, it goes to a state appeals board. From the state appeals board, it can go to a national appeals board. So we're talking a period in all reality that is going to be probably weeks or months, not days. And it is a very thorough process. In fact, one of our appeals board members, a recent appointee, is a member. He's a lawyer from Eugene and happens to be on the ACLU board. That's one of the reasons I placed him there, to ensure that we have people that are protecting the rights of persons seeking conscientious objector status.
Thank you.
Councilor Payne, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So help me on, let's go back to the average person who registers to drive at 16. I actually can't remember, you may or may not know, how many years that license is good for. 6 years or 8 years or whatever it is, that's kind of irrelevant. Multiple years. It's worth, it's
right.
Good for more than 2 years. At that point, are they giving any consent at all, or are they only giving consent in that case when they come up to renew their license at that point when they're over 18?
Okay. Going back to the language, it's in the bill. Person subject to the act is not subjecting anyone who is below 17 years, 11 months to registration. That's the key there. We did not make any provision for early submission of registration in the bill. That can be done individually on the internet, but it can't be done under the system. At the present time, there are electronic tapes from all of the states and territories that go to the Selective Service system. But unless they have passed, each state has passed legislation to allow for the implied consent, then all that is a checkoff and provides a means of them going back and sending letters out. And I recognize the concern here, but I think there is an absence of recognizing the loss of benefits that occur to these young men who do not register in a timely fashion, and it somewhat gets to be a balancing act, and it's a federal law that, in fact, it's a serious federal penalty. It's a $250,000 fine and 5 years in jail is a maximum penalty. So that's what could await a person who does not file. Who did not register if a mobilization comes along. So there is substantial protection that is offered here, and I think that the law and the process is set up to provide for that religious, ethical, or moral issue that a person has, and it's recognized, and it's one of the places that we spend a great deal of time in training to make sure that those individual rights are protected.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So does the consent come on the day they turn 18, they already have a license, or does the consent come at the point at which they renew that license? They're over 18.
Okay. If it's under the language of this bill, it would have to be at the renewal, because when that information is submitted, and it's submitted in a very short time after the application, whether it's 16, 17, or whatever, if they're not subject at that point, they could not be registered.
Further questions? Thank you.
Well, I have a question. In your testimony, you said many young men fail to register because they're not aware of the requirement. Do you know percentage-wise how many of this affects in Oregon, or number-wise?
Well, we start out in the low compliance rate in the low 70s. The vast majority of those occurring through the high school process. We have what we call high school registrars, which is usually a counselor or assistant principal, who basically put up a sign by a computer saying, hey, seniors, be sure and do this. All of those who are applying for any kind of student aid, it's almost automatic. They check, they want student aid, and if they check the block, that is the registration process at that point, so long as they have a Social Security number. And so it's we go from about a 26 or 27% non-compliance for 18-year-olds. We get down to about 10% non-compliance. That equates to about 2,500 young men per year in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Follow up? I guess I would ask you the same question I asked Mr. Wong, and that is, would you have a problem with offering that
instead of making it compulsory to register, at least say here you can register while you're here at the DMV. And would that not suit the purposes of what you're intending?
I don't have a personal problem with that. I think that I believe that Iowa and possibly one other state has a similar process. I don't have the copy of their information with me today, but I know that there are I think two states. They have found, I'm told now, this is information given to me and I don't have personal knowledge of it, but they have had, in one of the states that enacted that legislation, they've had only one or two people who opt out. Mm-hmm. But it's still a potential, and if it were the committee's desire, I would report back with additional information on that.
I would like to know.
If you'll bring us additional information,
I'll
appreciate it.
I'll see if I'll get that to you before the week's out.
That's great. Any further questions? Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
That's all I have on the list for 2575. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on 2575? Close the hearing on 2575. And because of the similarity in bills, I'm going to open a hearing on 2611 and 2947. Yeah. You want to do both of them?
I can do both of them.
I'll get a drink of water.
Mr. Chair, committee members, these bills are, in fact, very similar. I'll start with House Bill 2611. It basically requires an individual to submit a Social Security number to the State Department of Transportation when they apply for the issuance, renewal, replacement, or reinstatement of a driver's license, driver's permit, or ID card. It also allows ODOT to provide by rule for the acceptance of another number or identifying information if it determines that the individual does not have a Social Security number. It all would also require ODOT to verify the Social Security numbers that are submitted or the alternate identification unless the number or the alternate identification has been previously verified. The two basic differences between House Bill 2947 and House Bill 2611 are, one, 2947 actually specifies the types of alternative information that can be submitted, which would include a certified birth certificate, a passport, or a document showing that the person is a naturalized citizen or a legal resident of the United States. The second difference is that 2947 also includes a provision that would provide that a driver's license, permit, or ID card issued to a temporary resident would expire on the date that that legal residency expires.
Thank you, John. We have quite a few people signed up. I think we'll struggle along. I think we'll make it all right in time. I'm going to ask Lorna Youngs to come up and give us an idea of what the department currently does. And then you can go ahead and address the bills, too.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Gilman, my name is Lorna Youngs with the Department of Transportation, and I am the administrator of the DMV. I've prepared testimony on both bills, and it's pretty similar. As was pointed out, the bills have a great deal of overlap. So what I want to do first for you is just give you some background of what DMV does with Social Security numbers, what our capability of verification is, and then you can get into the details of the bills. Currently, we do collect Social Security numbers for two purposes. The first one is in compliance with federal regulations for commercial drivers. We collect Social Security numbers before the issuance of any commercial driver license, and it is that Social Security number that becomes the number that ties that driver's information with him and allows that driver to move from state to state, and it's his record or her record to go with him. So that is a federal mandate, and we're currently collecting Social Security numbers now on commercial drivers. Last session, a bill was introduced that would require us to collect Social Security numbers on what we call regular Class C or just ordinary driver's licenses. And that was to bring the state in compliance with the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, which required that states collect Social Security numbers on all licenses that it issued. Oregon had been out of compliance, and an audit revealed that if it did not get into compliance, considerable federal child welfare funding would be in jeopardy, and so that statute was passed. In neither case does Oregon verify the Social Security number that we receive. Also, those individuals that hold a regular driver license who do not possess a Social Security number are able to sign a certificate that says they do not have a Social Security number, are not eligible for a Social Security number, and therefore are issued a driver license. And that represents about 3% of the driver license issuance process. We do see some value in the verification of Social Security numbers because one of our goals is to make sure that the data in our database is accurate. And at this point, since a person is not required to even show us their Social Security card when they're providing us that number, we're not entirely confident that that number is accurate. However, and there are a number of states that are on the what we call the Solve system, which is an online process that you can verify Social Security numbers with. That is connected through the American Motor Vehicle Association and is available to motor vehicle agencies. And it's actually an online process, so it can be done at the counter. The only other electronic verification system that is nationwide that we know of is a system that is available through the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services for the alien verification or the alien registration number. So while one bill specifies the specific documents that would be required, which is House Bill 2947, and the other bill, House Bill 2611, allows the department to choose other kinds of documents or other kinds of numbers that may be substituted for the Social Security number. In fact, there is only one other number that we could electronically verify. So verification, and what is meant by verification in this bill, is important because birth certificates and passports, there is not currently an online verification system set up that departments of motor vehicles can use. I know there are some pilot programs put together, but we're not at the state where we could use those. So we really are, if you're looking for two numbers that we can electronically verify at the counter, we are limited to the Social Security number and the alien registration number, which means that House Bill 2611 would then become a de facto legal presence bill. House Bill 2947, in fact, is a legal presence bill because you'll note the only documents that can be used in lieu of a Social Security number are documents that can be made that are only obtainable by individuals who are either born in the United States or who are legally present in the United States. So this bill carries with it all the same issues that you heard previously with House Bill 2608. So our fiscal impact and our testimony is based on the assumption that what you mean by verification is an electronic verification process, that we would be verifying only Social Security number or alien registration number. And those, I think, are the issues that you would need to wrestle with as you take a look at both bills. Now, I do have one suggestion for you, and that is if what you are interested in is the verification of Social Security numbers, Washington is an example of a state, like Oregon, that does not have a legal presence requirement, but does verify Social Security number through the Solve system. They, like Oregon, allow those individuals who do not have Social Security numbers to continue to sign a certificate indicating that they don't have a Social Security number. But for the rest of the population, which is the majority of the population that do have a Social Security number, they verify those and if there is a discrepancy, they don't issue until that discrepancy is resolved. So that is one possible thing that you may take a look at if the issue of legal presence, if you don't want to juxtapose the issue of legal presence with verification of Social Security number. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
We're going to hold questions until Representative Cup
okay.
is able to come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be back for you for the second time today. State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. House Bill 2947 is something that I thought was appropriate not long after we learned that, after the events of September 11th, 2001, that a number of the hijackers of those aircraft had numerous licenses between them, driver's licenses. And that began, with a great many other people, began wondering, why don't we have a greater sense of what is the reality of obtaining driver's licenses in Oregon? I think it was about 4 years ago in this body, during the time that we were here, that a story broke about a smuggling ring that was busted by the federal government in Baker City. And what they were doing was transporting folks up from Nevada to get an Oregon driver's license, because it's very easy and very simple to get an Oregon driver's license. All you have to prove is that you're a resident here, or that you're here. And they would go back then to Nevada, which had a higher standard, and exchange those driver's licenses for Nevada driver's licenses. And this was a fairly profitable little enterprise for a group of individuals. And so the more that we began to look into this, I and others began to think that the integrity of our driver's license, which really is the keys to the kingdom anymore, I mean, you show your driver's license just about everywhere to show people that you are who you say you are. Except that the integrity of the driver's license system in America has improved dramatically since 9/11, but I fear that in Oregon our standard is simply far too low. And what the incidence of not only people saying that they are who they are, but it's been exasperated greatly by the issues of identity theft, and I know that that's an issue that you all are looking at, and Representative Bruhn specifically has been involved in that. The Senate has a number of bills to deal with that. This is the concept that we're talking about here, Social Security verification electronically, is one of those pieces of the puzzle of ensuring that people are who they say they are with a driver's license. This can be done, I think, relatively inexpensively. We talked to the folks in Idaho who recently implemented the system. They spent about $1,500 to update their entire software system at the Department of Motor Vehicles. It cost them about, I believe it's 3 cents per transaction. They can send batches at a time, and that's from for about 1 penny per transaction. As you know, it can be done electronically at the counter. There are 41 states doing this today. I guess the question I would ask is, why isn't Oregon? Now, Oregon is known for being this state that's on the cutting edge in a lot of things. Salmon Plan, Oregon Health Plan, lots of interesting ideas. Why are we in the Stone Age on this one? And I think you have the opportunity to change that today. Does this solve every problem there is? No. If you've stolen someone's Social Security number, this doesn't fix that problem. But for people who are buying Social Security numbers off the street, this fixes that problem. Because when you go to the DMV to get your driver's license and it comes back unverified, or not valid, I think is the proper term, then you'll be denied that driver's license because you're not who you say you are. Or if there is a problem, you have the opportunity then to correct it, which is one of the side benefits of this very issue. It has, again, very low implementation cost, and she just described how that system is available through the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. And frankly, there's very little that it would cost us to do this. But I think the benefit would be monumental in what it would get us in terms of the integrity of our driver's licenses in this state. Obviously, you need to know that H.R. 418, the Real ID Act, was passed in the U.S. House of Representatives on February 10th with a vote of 261-161. It's likely going to be folded into a supplemental appropriations bill for the war in Iraq. And if that happens, it is a requirement that all applicants must prove that they are lawfully in the United States of America. So the federal government may be sending this issue our way relatively soon. And I think that it would be improper for us not to take this action today. Because if you do not prove legal presence and you have an Oregon driver's license, and when you go to get on an airplane and you pull out that driver's license, they're going to say, you know what, we can't let you on this airplane because you don't meet the federal requirement of the federal law that is likely going to be passed. So again, I would say, why are we in the Stone Ages? If 41 other states think that this is a proper direction to go, why are we not doing it in Oregon? And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Representative. Questions?
Oh.
I just have a quick comment, maybe.
Representative Thatcher first.
Well, just real quickly, you mentioned that smuggling ring in Baker, and all I can say now is Nevada won't even accept Oregon driver's licenses when you go to get a Nevada driver's license.
Well, and I tried to take some notes from Ms. Young's testimony. And I thought she said they currently collect Social Security numbers. Is the difference that the DMV does not verify them? Is that what you're saying?
Ms. Young, would you mind coming back up to you? Do you mind representing?
Not at all. I'm always pleased to be joined by Lorna. Good to see you again.
Thank you.
Okay. Again.
Representative Gilman, Representative Boone, that is correct. During the last session, we were given the authority to collect, but not the authority to verify.
And then, follow up, this bill then just gives that authority to verify.
Representative Boone, yes, among other things, it gives the authority to verify, yes.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, it is the intent, my intent as the drafter of this legislation, to not only make certain that these are electronically verified, but also to do as Lorna had testified in her previous testimony, this bill purposefully establishes the requirement of legal presence. Because, again, likely the federal government will be sending that issue and will require that. And the very issue that I brought forward to you of some difficulties in being able to traverse this country using a driver's license may occur if we do not establish a legal presence statute in this state.
And one last clarification, since you're up here, Lorna. You said about 3% don't provide a Social Security number, and then they can sign off something and still receive a license.
Representative Gilman, Representative Boone, yes, that was a provision in the passage of the statute last time, that those individuals who did not have a Social Security number, because either they were, since Oregon is a state that does not require legal presence, if you're not here legally, you can't have a Social Security number. So in order for the bill, which was to put us in compliance with the Child Welfare Reform Act, not to eliminate the possibility of driver licensing for illegal immigrants, and then there are some individuals who are natural citizens or were born here who for some reason or another never worked and don't have a Social Security number. So in either case, if you don't have one or not eligible for one, you sign a form that states never had one, not eligible for one, essentially, and then we issue.
And then how would this bill then address those Does that affect those 3%?
Representative Gilman, Representative Boone, for the way in which the bill, which bill are we talking about? If we're talking about... If we're talking about 2947, there are provisions in that bill for a birth certificate, a valid passport, or a document showing that a person is a naturalized citizen or that they are a legal resident. The last two, the naturalized citizen and the legal resident, if they have an alien registration number, then there is, I have testified earlier, an online system called SAVE that would allow us to verify that. But the issue that I was trying to raise in my testimony is it is not clear from the reading of the bill what is meant by verification, because there isn't a system available to verify passports or verify birth certificates. Currently, that's a visual examination done at the counter based on the information that we have about the security features in that. And so that's a key to how the bill is intended to be implemented. Now, admittedly, that it, the number of individuals who are U.S. born and don't have a Social Security number is very small. But I don't know how I would be able to verify their documents online.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it isn't the intent, it isn't my intent as the drafter of this legislation, so let me establish this for the public record right now. It is not my intent that a passport or any other form of documentation would have to be verified. Okay, only the Social Security number to be online verified. And the reason for that is, Lorna has just clearly articulated to you, is it's virtually impossible to fully verify those other items without some lengthy process that ensues. Now, if that's a direction that the committee would like to go, then I'm open to that suggestion. The reason that we put those qualifiers in the legislation as being acceptable for the department to accept is because generally it's much harder to obtain a false passport. It's much, much harder these days than it used to be. Legal residency, the alien registration system, if someone has gone to the trouble of registering it within that system, obviously what they've done is they've shown, I believe, a good faith effort at representing themselves to be who they say they are. Because the intent of this legislation is to deny driver's licenses to those who purposefully and willfully disobey the law and present themselves to be someone other than who they really are. And again, I bring forward to you the context of why I brought this legislation forward was because the people on 9/11 who attacked this country were not who they said they were. And that's the reason we're doing this, in my opinion. And that's, again, I'm sharing with you my reasonings why and what my intention is with this legislation for the public record. And if we need to clarify that to address the department's concern, I'm very, very willing, very happy to do so. That is not my intention. Those documents, I believe, are vetted enough in today's current climate to be deemed valid, in my opinion. It's the online registration, verification of Social Security numbers, which is a humongous problem in the United States of America today, and that's what we're trying to get out here.
Representative Thatcher, then we'll come to this slide.
Oh, sorry. I just want to clarify with the drafter here, Representative Krupp. In line 20, it says a document showing that a person is a legal resident of the United States. There are, I am guessing it's a work visa, it's called an H-2A, that gives a person legal status here to work, I mean, for a period of a year, but it isn't in their possession. I'm not totally familiar with, maybe somebody else there in the audience could fill me in, but I don't know if they would get a copy of this or what, but it seems like they are legal residents, but the document is in the possession of the employer, is my understanding. And I'm just wondering how something like that would work. Maybe you're not familiar with immigration law to that degree, but
Mr. Chair and Representative Thatcher, we can find a way to make that work. I'm pretty confident. Again, if someone has gone to the trouble of getting an H-2A, has a green card and is here legally to work, it is not my intention to deny them a driver's license, because they have, again, they've been very diligent in following our laws, and if there's a way that we need to provide that is a valid document, then that's fine. But and I'd be happy to work with you on that.
Over on this side. Oh, come on. Can't believe it.
That was good. Just check if it did. In the interest of balance.
Oh, Representative, that worries me. When you say
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Krupp, I'd like to get this absolutely clear. The intent is only to verify Social Security number, even though we have the means electronically to verify the alien registration number.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, that is correct. That's the intent of the law. If it pleases the legislative body of this committee to expand on that through the verbiage of this legislation, that is all right with me.
Sure. Actually, I would submit that the way this is drafted right now, for example, page 1, lines 27 and 28, require verification of any of these types of documents. And I think therein lies the question. So if the intent is indeed to only verify Social Security number, then I would submit that we may need to do some amendments here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Burley, I stand corrected. You're correct. The verbiage of the bill does indeed allow for the verification of the other documentation. And I appreciate you pointing that out to me. And we can do whatever the committee's pleasure would be in that regard. If it is reasonable to be able to electronically verify other forms of documentation, I'm fine with that. If there is an unreasonable burden in a particular area that would be difficult or virtually impossible to verify, then we can make an exception for that.
Further questions?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's see. Michael Forrest.
Where's this set? Dan?
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gilman and board members. This is only the second time I've been in before the committee, so butterflies are a little gone. So I'm here to support the House Bill 29. Oh, I'm sorry. You need my name? I'm sorry. Mike Forrest. I'm from Salem, Oregon. And I am here to support Bill 2947. I think it's an excellent bill. It's the first time, and I would like to say the people who sponsored and co-sponsored it, I want to say thank you. Because you've had the courage to stand up and throw political correctness out the door. And you're doing, I feel, what is right to protect Oregon and its citizens. I think it's a good thing. I just want to thank you ahead of time. But this bill will protect all of us, the citizens of Oregon and the USA. This bill would put us in line with the Real ID Act and to verify licenses, ID cards, whatever it may be. And I have no problem with that myself, is to prove who I am, what I am, am I eligible for this license? I have no problem with that. I think it's an excellent idea. I'm willing, even willing to front the cost. I mean, you know, of my check, so that's no problem with me. The thing about this bill is it treats, I think, everybody equally. And the exciting thing I like about this bill, it treats every, it makes every one of us accountable for who we are. Are we here? Are we eligible? And I like that. It makes me accountable. I like the part of the checking the verification of the Social Security numbers. I think that's an excellent idea. And as I just heard the testimony, I think it's a good idea to check all ID. I mean, if they're applying for a driver's license here for Oregon, I think it's our responsibility to protect every citizen and say, is that who they are? I think it's a good idea. Not try to learn from mistakes. And from 9/11, I think is a wake-up call. I think we all need to learn from that because it's very serious, and yes, it can happen in Oregon. And basically what I want to say is please pass this bill. And as for ODOT, and excuse my verbiage, but I'm not sure who the brain is who come up with the matricular ID card to be used as ID. That's bewildered me since I've, you know, been learning about this. I have no idea why that is used, because only illegal immigrants or someone not supposed to be here has that card. So I'm bewildered. So, and that's all I got to say. And I want to thank you, Rep. Gilman, and members of the committee, and thank you for this time.
Thank you, Michael. Questions?
Good.
Thank you very much, Eduardo.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the board. For the record, my name is Eduardo Angulo. I am the chairman of the Salem Kaiser Coalition for Equality here in the Marion County. We are 11 community organizations, starting with Mano Mano Family Center, Latinos Unidos Siempre, our youth organization, the Salem Kaiser NAACP, and the Salem Kaiser NAACP Youth Chapter. We have Willamette University Mecha students. We also have PECUN, the Farm Workers Union, largest farm workers union in Oregon. We have CAUSA, our Oregon Pro-Immigrant Rights Coalition. And we have our Bilingual and Migrant Parents Association, and also Citizens for Livable Communities. I am here today to testify against House Bill 2611 and House Bill 2947. House Bill 2611 and House Bill 2947 require a social security number in order for people to obtain a driver's license, permit, or identification card in Oregon. It will deny driver licenses to Oregon's undocumented immigrants who do not have access to a valid social security number. Additionally, House Bill 2947 links driver licenses to the applicant's legal residence status by providing that the driver license expire on the same date as their status. This piece of anti-immigrant legislation does nothing for homeland security and will only put Oregonians at risk, because it will lead to an increase in unlicensed, uninsured drivers on the road. The proponents argue that licensing undocumented immigrants rewards unlawful conduct and jeopardizes national security. A at first look, this argument has superficial appeal. But in fact, the evidence and common sense show that licensing all persons in the United States who can present reliable, secure identity documents, but regardless of immigration status, strengthens our national security, promotes highway safety, and increases insured motorist rates. People talk about national security. Licensing undocumented immigrants on the basis of reliable identity documents actually promotes national security and assists law enforcement authorities by identifying who is in our country. Restrictive licensing undermines, not enhances, national security by pushing people deeper into the shadows and fueling a black market for false documents. Moreover, it will severely diminish the law enforcement ability to motor vehicle databases by reducing rather than expanding government data on individuals in the country. Our security depends on people, whether documented or not, having the means to identify themselves and to cooperate with the police and other law enforcement authorities. Our ability to locate terrorists is enhanced if law enforcement officials can find the people they are looking for. Driver's license database are a useful tool for this purpose. The truth is that 9/11 hijackers could have qualified for driver licenses even in states requiring documentation of valid immigration status. They were all here on United States government's issued visas. They were not undocumented people. The issue of public safety calls for the primary purpose of Oregon state law that governs the driver license system is public safety. Unlicensed drivers have not been tested for driving competence or their knowledge of the rules of the road. According to the American Automotive Association Foundation for Traffic Safety, in its report, Unlicensed to Kill, unlicensed drivers are almost five times more likely to be in fatal crash than are validly licensed drivers.
Eduardo?
Yes, sir.
This is essentially the same testimony that you gave a couple of days ago here when we had...
Last week. Yes. Chairman Gilman.
Because of that, could you summarize it?
Okay. I am coming to a closing, Chairman, and I am sorry because these are very similar bills,
yeah.
and the requirements are almost the same. And also, I noticed that there were some of the members of the committee that weren't present. So I want to take that, the opportunity to fill you all up in what we believe is the right thing to do. The impact on Oregon residents and businesses. Oregon has a significant immigrant population. These individuals comprise the backbone of our agricultural, and many other seasonal and service jobs throughout Oregon. Denying them driver licenses imposes extreme hardship on our Latino and immigrant communities throughout Oregon. Not only hurting them and their families and their children, many of whom, I might point out, are U.S. citizens, but most important for most Oregonians, it is bad for our economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about the potential of strengthening what our current laws to make it, at least as I understood it, to make it to require even stronger, more reliable proof of identity.
Exactly.
Not getting into other citizenship issues. Do you have some specific suggestions, or is there, I'm not aware of pending legislation. Are you aware of some pending legislation, or do you have any specific suggestions of the specific kind of ways that we could do that in terms of strengthening our current laws to require more reliable proof of identity?
Well, I think I would really would leave that for the DMV personnel. I am part of a task force that has been assembled by the leadership of the DMV, a Latino task force, where we have been working with the DMV leadership on finding ways for, because as the representative cop was mentioning, the main issue here is identity theft. Identity theft is big with the Latino community too, with the immigrant community too. And we are working on constructive ways, and I think that maybe the DMV director can address this. There are already in place many provisions that restrict people that are not who they say they are from getting a driver license in Oregon.
Any further questions, Patrick? Representative?
Yeah, it's my understanding, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the matricular consular card, if I'm naming that correctly, is given to just about anybody who asks for one. Is this not true?
I am not an expert. I know that the Mexican consulate, they check back with their databases in Mexico, but please do not quote me on it. I think that there is a process that they follow up with the people that are trying to get a matricula consular here at the Portland consulate, but I think that they will be in a better position to give you a complete answer on that.
Follow up, because I too believe that we need to have some real reliable ID, and from what I was reading about the matricular consular card, unless I am mistaken, once again, that it's pretty loose as far as who gets one. I mean, it could be issued to anybody, it sounds like. but I would like to follow through and find some more information on that. But just doing some more looking around, it looks like even, and the U.S. government refers to people, individuals who are not citizens or nationals of the U.S. as aliens.
Yes.
So, barring little green men from Mars, it's also all I think of when I think of aliens, but there are all kinds of different ways, it looks like, to even get a Social Security number as an alien, and that there are all kinds of ways to also prove that you're legally present, such as getting, I mean, it looks like a bureaucratic nightmare, I have to admit, but I'm just wondering, what's wrong with going through the legal hoops to get, to show that you are here, here legally?
Well, Chairman Gilman, Representative Thatcher, our state of Oregon has made incredible efforts in making sure that the people, and I should say the DMV of the state of Oregon has made incredible progress in making sure that people that get a driver license in Oregon are who they say they are. I think that at the last testimony, the gentleman that was in charge of of the DMV offices throughout the state. He was asked regarding how many incidents do you get that people that apply are not who they say they are. And I think that he referred to 2 cases a month. I don't know if maybe the people from the DMV can give you a better answer. I don't have all the expertise on the issue as it is.
Just one follow-up. Yes, sure. I think what he was saying is that he ran into 1 or 2 cases a month where they had faked documents that they could see, but I think that was what he stated in his testimony.
Don't most of the farm workers have to have a social security number? Or, and Lorna, if you could come up again and talk about this card that I can't even pronounce the name of.
Again, for the record, Lorna Young's DMV. Because Oregon does not require legal presence, and because Oregon, since 2004, changed our requirements in that we would not accept any documents that were not in English, that left us in the position of how would you be able to ask for 2 forms of identification from individuals who are not legally present in the United States that are in English. They cannot legally have a Social Security number because you have to be legally present to be eligible for a Social Security number. So we knew we could not use that document as a basis. We were no longer using the Mexican birth certificate or Guatemalan birth certificate because most of the immigrants that are not here legally are from Spanish-speaking countries. So what we did was to work specifically with the Oregon Mexican consulate because they can read the documents. They can read the birth certificates from Mexico, and based on that and other identification documents that those individuals carry that are written in Spanish, such as their voter registration card, they then become essentially a certifier because they are a consulate. Consulates issue passports, in essence. If a person comes in from another country with a foreign passport, they've satisfied the identity requirements of that consulate. I cannot speak for all of the consulates in the United States. I cannot speak for the validity of all the matricular cards in the United States. We only accept the matricular card issued by the Portland consulate because we worked very closely with them on their processes for verifying the original documentation that they receive from the individuals and the processes that they put in place in terms of security features in their cards. And for us, that was the best compromise that we could establish to still abide by our new requirements to have identity documentation written in English that has name and date of birth that could be made available legally to individuals who are not legally present in Oregon.
Okay, any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The two of you. Don't go away, woman.
No, no, don't leave the room.
I don't know. Maybe Stephen Witt? You don't write any better than I do.
That's a long story.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Reverend Stephen Witte. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Farm Worker Ministry. Oregon Farm Worker Ministry strongly opposes both House Bill 2611 and 2947, which would deny driver's licenses to Oregon's undocumented workers who do not have access to valid Social Security number. Both bills do nothing for Homeland Security. Nothing. If anything, these bills will affect less security. National security is enhanced when people have access to lawful documents and are able to identify themselves, and when law enforcement can use scarce resources wisely in investigating and preventing terrorism. As proposed, these bills will stigmatize and marginalize ordinary immigrants, making law enforcement less available to them. The reality produced by these bills, if these bills are adopted, these restrictions will be incentives for non-citizens to seek fraudulent documents on the black market. A Nebraska colleague of mine, Reverend Mary Ayana, Director of Missions for All Nations, shared this with me some time ago. And she said, before the law was changed in Nebraska and started requiring a Social Security number to obtain a driver's license, we preached to our congregation that they must obey the laws of the land and specifically mentioned driver's licenses and auto insurance. Now people who are already here and have difficulty correcting their immigration status have no opportunity to be legal in these other areas. Like Pastor Mary, there are many of us who work tirelessly for our sisters and brothers without the documentation we would like for them to possess. Further criminalizing this population makes no sense. These are the people who harvest our food and make agriculture possible here in Oregon. These are people who do backbreaking work that many in our society will not accept. They are integral to our economy. They clean our public buildings and often care for our elderly. Like it or not, they are human beings who are seeking to support themselves and their families. They are here. It is morally wrong to heap another obstacle in their way. I hope and pray that the state of Oregon will not enshrine additional discrimination into the codices of state law. Let us work together to support those measures which will enable all residents of Oregon to become more uniformly part of our society with the responsibilities as well as the privileges that go with living here. Assuring that people who drive are qualified to do so will help diminish accidents and ensure higher standards of responsible behavior. I strongly oppose both these bills. I would like to add that, you know, quite often the 9/11 scenario has been invoked, you know, in this whole fear scenario. We're not going to accomplish anything by invoking fear. Granted, we have a population within the state of Oregon of questionable documentation status. They are here. They are part of our economy. They are part of our communities. And rather pushing these folks farther into the margins, let's find ways to incorporate them. If it's a matter of finding some ways of making them, pursuing them on the path to legal residency, then let's do so. But to arbitrarily use the driver's license as a means to do this, all you're going to do is be fostering another black market. You know, I can't see any other possibility. I think we need to find ways to incorporate these folks into our society. Like I said, you know, just by wishing them away or saying or denying them a driver's license is not going to make them disappear. And I think we need to find ways to incorporate them into our communities and make their status legal. Let's find ways to work with them, not against them, for heaven's sakes.
Thank you, Reverend. Any questions? That's Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. I guess I should have asked previous testimony, but when I hear the word or the term undocumented workers, do you mean those who are not here legally?
Most instances, yes.
Okay, and are most of the people that you are referring to in your testimony farm workers and that not here legally, you're saying?
Well, there is a percentage of them, of questionable. You know, now that doesn't mean they may not have all the proper documentation. They may have none. They may have some. You know, you can't categorize all these folks in one broad stroke. These are poor people. They, you know, many of them, English is a second or third language. They don't understand all the nuances of our laws. And, you know, and quite frankly, many of our folks have recruited them to be here in the first place. It's as a result of what our country has done that has pushed them off their indigenous places. They're just trying to provide for their families like any one of us would do. So, you know, I think rather than criminalizing or, you know, pushing these folks further in, let's find a way to incorporate them into society. If you want to be able to people to prove who they are, then let's find a way to, to honestly and fairly do it. You know, no matter what we're going to do, you know, I mean, if you want to know who everybody is, then let's tattoo a barcode on everybody or put a microchip like we put in our animals. You know, I mean that's basically what you're saying is if everybody's going to have to prove to that degree, you know, I mean, you know, let's face it, the last time a society, you know, numbered people in a visible way was in the 40s, and we know where, and we know the outcome. I mean, I don't think it makes any sense. I think, you know, yes, I understand that there are questions, but I think, you know, to go on to some of this, I think it's just unconscionable. And I would like to think in the state of Oregon that we are a bit more enlightened in this, that to let fear be the motivation.
Reverend, I'm going to request that you relax a little bit. And if you don't, I will not ask you to speak any longer. Do you understand that?
I'm just passionate.
You can call it whatever word you want, but I will not tolerate it here.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gosh, I almost forgot what I was going to say. but I do. I was looking at some. There are a number of ways to establish your presence, and I will say again, once again, it looks like a bureaucratic nightmare to go through this. And I'm wondering, is there, through your ministry or other ministries, help available to help these people get documented so they can establish their presence legally here? Because it looks like there's all kinds of forms that are out there, from alien registration receipt cards to work. They put a bunch of letters and numbers attached to it, but there's a number of ways, and I'm wondering what is wrong with pursuing that.
It all boils down to money. We are a small not-for-profit organization. We don't have the funds or resources to do this. All we can do is we can, you know, educate and enlighten people on what the situation is. You know, if there were funding to do so, I'm sure that you know, any of these people with questionable documentation would be more than willing to do so. They don't want to be breaking the law.
Okay.
For the question, yes,
Representative. You several times, and it's in your written testimony, commented about how these bills would further criminalize this population, and I'm curious how would this criminalize the population?
Okay, if they, you know, if everything's tied to a Social Security number, they do not have a Social Security number available to them, then what does that make them? Well, I mean, it's obvious. I mean, it's passing a law that's saying you have to have a particular document or a particular certification, and if they at this present time are not able to obtain that, maybe according to their own fault or not, in some cases, then
actually, excuse me for interrupting, but actually, what this says is that you have to have that to get an Oregon driver's license.
Okay.
If you don't have it, you simply would not get an Oregon driver's license. Now, the only criminal act would be if that person then gets behind the wheel and drives without an Oregon driver's license, and that, sir, is a personal choice.
But if these are folks here that are trying to make a living, and for every one of them, they are supporting more people than just themselves.
I can appreciate that.
Then, you know,
excuse me. Please, let's stay focused on the question. This does not create criminals out of anybody until that person subsequently makes a personal choice to drive without a license.
Okay, but then could you explain to me how these people might get to their employment or support their families?
No, I cannot.
See, that's the conundrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Thank you, Reverend.
Richard Hinkey.
Hinkley.
You'll get credit on handwriting.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Hickey. I'm a resident of Salem. I'm not going to read this whole thing. I just wanted to highlight it. Don't worry. I just wanted you to have what I feel are recent, not a long time ago, recent examples of our people in our nation suffering because we don't know who's here. We don't know why they're here. We don't know what their intentions are. And this is just some shocking testimony in here. One thing I would like to that is not in here is I've heard the argument that, well, now they'll get insurance. Okay. I'm an insurance agent myself. I know other insurance agents. I hate to admit it, but I know people that buy insurance just to get their license and then they stop paying for it. I know people that get insurance just to get their tags renewed, their registration updated, and then they simply stop paying for it. So I take that argument with a grain of salt. And I would like to state, obviously, also that legal immigrants should be the only people that can get a driver's license for obvious reasons. Then we know who they are, and we know what their intentions are. And that's America. We're all about immigration. I understand that. I'm a great-grandchild myself. I love that. Of course, they came here legally. Anyway, I wanted to cover some what I feel are quite shocking facts. Reported last September, according to this report in Raleigh, North Carolina, the North Carolina Department of Motor Vehicles has issued as many as 400,000 driver's licenses to individuals without Social Security numbers by simply entering 999-999-999 on the application. Those 400,000 people, we don't know, are they really just here for a job? Are they terrorists? Are they murderers? We don't know. That's a concern that I have. Salt Lake Tribune, Salt Lake City, Utah. A legislative audit showed that the state issued roughly 95,000 driver's license or ID cards to undocumented residents, and of those people, 383 registered to vote. 383 people voting. Doesn't sound like a big deal. I would like to remind everyone listening that in the state of Washington, that governor race was decided by less than 200 votes. So I think 383 people that are not supposed to be here voting is a concern. It could be 400 people from Iran or Syria deciding our next governor. Yesterday in the Boston Globe, for the second time since the 2001 terrorist attacks, undocumented workers obtained passes to some of the most secure areas of Logan International Airport. Logan International is where two of those planes on 9/11 took off. 14 Brazilian immigrants who authorities are saying in the country illegally were arrested at the airport just last week. March 8th of this year, before the U.S. Congress, the director of our FBI, Robert Mueller, he told a congressional panel that illegal aliens from countries with ties to Al-Qaeda have crossed into the U.S. from Mexico using false identities. I don't want them to come here and get a driver's license. He says some of the aliens are people with Middle Eastern names who have adopted Hispanic last names before coming into the U.S. He says, quote, we're concerned. Homeland Security is concerned about special interest aliens entering the United States. For those that are not aware, special interest aliens are those from countries where Al-Qaeda is known to be active. They also report that he said that one route takes Middle Easterners to Brazil, where they assume false identities before entering Mexico and then crossing into the United States. I don't want them to come here and get a driver's license. Also, the AP reported that the Deputy of Homeland Security Secretary, Admiral James Loy, told Congress that Al-Qaeda operatives believe that they can pay to get into the country through Mexico and that entering illegally is, quote, more advantageous than legal entry. Senate testimony last year by Michelle Malkin. I'm going to edit it way down. I won't read the whole thing, but something very shocking to me. More than half of the 48 Islamic radicals convicted or tied to terrorist plots in the past decade either were themselves illegal aliens or relied on illegals to get fake IDs. to include the first attack on the World Trade Center back in 1993, the LA Millennium bombing plot, and the subway bombing conspiracy in New York. And yes, they did have government-issued visas. But three of these hijackers were pulled over by state and local police days before the attacks for speeding. If you gave a police officer an expired visa, maybe they would have looked into their background. But when you show them a state-issued ID, why would they look into their background? Maybe those people would have been caught. I think the driver's licenses helped them avoid detection of what their intentions were. It's obviously a possibility. I also remind people that we heard about a horrible incident in Klamath Falls last year where two nuns were raped. One of them was beaten, choked to death with their own rosary beads. And again, this is someone that's illegally here who served time in California, jail in California, had already been arrested in Portland on drug charges and had an outstanding warrant for his arrest. My point being, I don't want rapists and killers to know that they can come here to get photo ID. Oh, I forgot about Deputy David March of L.A., who pulled somebody over on a routine traffic stop and was shot in the head. And this person also was deported three times and convicted of two felonies. Again, I don't want him coming back. I don't want him to come. You can't get a photo ID, driver's license in California. I don't want him to come to Oregon to get that. Very important statistics about immigration facts, which totally relate to this, because if even you or I decided we're going to move to a foreign country, we decide we want to live and work in a foreign country without the approval of that government, the first thing we need is identification. It's very difficult to get a job without ID unless you're willing to work under the table, or to get a place to live or a car without some form of ID. So the first thing someone's going to do, a foreign national illegally in a nation, is look for some type of identification. I don't want Oregon to be a magnet for that anymore. Interesting statistics, I'll be real quick. 97% of all asylum seekers from any country who were released from immigration were never apprehended again by the federal government and never deported. 94% of aliens from terrorist-supporting countries who were released from immigration never found, never deported, and 87% of all aliens released from immigration were never caught and never deported. Couple things to go. This is quite shocking out of the Tucson Republic. This is March 18th of this year. And before I read this little blip, I hope that most of us can agree. Probably most people that would take the time and spend thousands to come all the way from Syria, all the way into Mexico, and into America, probably aren't coming to work in the fields and do jobs that supposedly we just, heck, won't do anymore. People from Syria, everybody has an opinion about it, but obviously that country's had some problems. A federal grand jury Wednesday indicted two Syrian men on charges of impersonating U.S. citizens after the Border Patrol stopped them in southern Arizona and found an undocumented Mexican immigrant in their car. This is the thing that concerns me. The agents reported that a second car, spotted traveling in tandem with these people, got away. How many others have gotten away? How many have not been caught? 9/11 Commission report. We all heard about that. Chapter 12, page 390. Their recommendation, secure ID should begin in the U.S. The federal government should set standards for the issuance of birth certificates and sources of ID, such as driver's licenses. Fraud in ID is no longer just a problem of theft. At many entry points to vulnerable facilities, including gates for boarding aircrafts, sources of ID are the last opportunity to ensure that people who say they are who they say they are, and to check whether or not they're terrorists. Last but not least, from the president of our National Border Patrol, issued August of last year, the terrorist attacks that occurred in 9/11 were not merely a failure of intelligence, they were also a profound failure of our immigration system. We cannot continue to pretend our homeland is secure for borders or not. He admits that they catch less than half of the illegals that come here, and last year they caught 1.2 million, but they admit they catch less than half of that. If it is so easy for impoverished and poorly educated people to cross our borders illegally, consider how much easier it is for well-financed and highly trained terrorists to do the same. And he asked for people to help protect America.
Thank you, Richard. I'm going to let you know that we will carry this over to next Wednesday because I have three more sheets of people that want to speak, and I intend to hear all of you, but it's going to take more than we can do today because we have to be out of here by 3 o'clock. Any questions for Richard? Thank you. Thank you, Bertins.
Thank you. Please support Bill 2947.
Wayne Brady.
You're going to take the test
today? How long will it take you?
It'll be very short.
Okay. We'll take one more.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Brady. I live at 3794 East Manich Circle South in Salem. And I'm here to support HB 2947. There are a couple of things I wanted to find out about. One is when they say verify the Social Security number, I would hope that they would make sure that it matches the name, sex, and date of birth, and not simply that it's a valid Social Security number. Do we have an answer to that?
The tape won't record our head nods.
Lorna Youngs again. By verification, in order to verify, you send in the name, the date of birth, and the Social Security number, and they all need to come back and match. So that's the verification process. Not that it's simply a Social Security number, but it is your Social Security number.
Another concern that I have, and you may be able to answer this one too,
mm-hmm.
You allow people to get a driver's license without a physical residence.
Mr. Chair, the question that I've been asked is what are our residency requirements in order to obtain a driver license? You need to be a resident of the state of Oregon. However, we do recognize that there are exceptions. There are homeless. And so we can use a physical description of where you're camping out as your physical address for those individuals who do not have a home.
About how many people fall in that category?
Now, wait a minute. You two can have this conversation out in the hall. We don't
anyway,
need to have it here.
I strongly support 2947.
And, okay. Thank you very much. And I'll close the hearing on 2947 and 2611. Thank you all for being here. Obviously, it's a little bit of a contentious discussion. The chair plans to move some sort of a bill along this line, so I want you all to stay tuned. Meeting adjourned.